Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready for argument in the case of Ryan against the United States. Mr. Alshuler.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. I'd like to devote this argument primarily to the question of harmless error, showing, one, that contrary to the argument of the government and the district court, the jury could have found Ryan guilty of undisclosed conflicts of interest without finding bribery. Two, that this court has already said so. Three, that you can't know the jury, the ground on which the jury reached its verdict, and so the instructional errors cannot be considered harmless under any standard, including the one proposed by the government. Four, that even if the evidence of bribery were overwhelming, that would not establish the harmlessness of the instructional errors. And five, that the evidence was far from overwhelming. But first, a word about waiver. Wood against Milliard holds that a federal court is not at liberty to override or excuse the government's waiver of a non-jurisdictional defense. And in this case, the government expressly conceded that Ryan made and preserved appropriate objections to the instructions that the district court held erroneous. Apparently stricken with buyer's remorse, the government now claims that its waiver wasn't knowing. It says that the waiver wasn't knowing because the government didn't know that the court would buy the argument if the government hadn't waived it. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers wishes that were the standard, but it's not. This court has said that a party's understanding of the consequences of its waiver need not be perfect. The government understood that it was giving up a claim of procedural default when it said that Ryan didn't default. It understood the nature of the claim and the consequences of abandoning it, and nothing more is required. The government waived not only this possible forfeiture claim, but also any claim that instructional errors and errors in the admission of evidence are not cognizable in post-conviction proceedings. It asked the district court and this court to evaluate evidentiary errors under the harmless error standard of United States against Owen, and although the parties disagree about which harmless error standard applies to the government's instructional errors, the government has agreed that Ryan is entitled to a new trial if these errors were not harmless. In light of Wood against Milliard and the government's waivers, this court should now decide the case on the basis of the issues submitted by the parties. And so if the court has no questions about the government's waivers, I'll turn to the question of harmless error. The instructions in this case mark four paths to conviction for honest services fraud, and three of them told the jury to convict Ryan of conduct that is not a crime. The district court concluded, however, that the jury could not have found Ryan guilty of non-criminal conduct without also finding him guilty of bribe-taking. The issue posed by this case is whether that conclusion was justified. If the jury could have convicted Ryan on any of the invalid instructions without finding bribery, no one can know the ground on which the jury rested its verdict. When that question is a toss-up, or there is even grave doubt about whether the error had a substantial and injurious effect, Ryan wins under any harmless error standard, including the one urged by the government. In this case, there is more than grave doubt. The jury almost certainly did not find that Ryan took bribes. The instructions offered a simpler path to conviction, and the jury almost certainly took it. Whether the benefits Ryan and his family received were bribes or legitimate gifts, the instructions told the jury that Ryan had a duty to disclose them.
So, Mr. Alshuler, you're presenting this argument as an across-the-board one. You're not seeing any distinctions between the counts relating to Warner and the count relating to Klein?
No, I'm not suggesting any distinction.
I mean, the facts are a little different. But.
Well, yes. I mean, in both cases, Ryan received some benefits, his members of his family received some benefits, and these people later received some favorable governmental decisions. The government says in return, we say not in return. It was just at most a matter of doing a favor for somebody who had done a favor for Ryan.
So you reject the Ganim idea that you can be on retainer, basically, that Justice Sotomayor, then Judge Sotomayor,
well, we certainly reject that fits the facts of this case. I mean, the district court talked a lot about streams of benefits, And we agree that streams of benefits flowing in both directions can sometimes warrant an inference of bribery. So we don't quarrel with the stream of benefits theory in that sense. But they do not automatically amount to bribery. President Obama can go sailing with a banker and can accept campaign contributions from a banker and can later favor a bailout for the banks without being guilty of bribery. It's not bribery to make a favorable governmental decision for somebody who has previously done personal favors for you. There has to be an agreement in place at the time the favors are received that the official will do something in return. And in fact, the court has already resolved.
When you say an agreement,
can be implicit.
It can be implicit. It can be an understanding. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Right.
Yeah. But the question before the jury is whether they can infer from the circumstances that the public official had agreed to do something for the person who had done him a favor.
How particular?
And this court has already ruled that the evidence is sufficient on that point. And we're not going to quarrel with that ruling at this point.
Now, how particular do you think it needs to be? What about the idea that you've accepted the money and then as the opportunity arises, as the phrase goes, you will reciprocate with favorable actions?
We don't think that the benefit needs to be specifically identified, despite the fact that the Supreme Court has actually said that on a few occasions. If you made an agreement to provide a benefit to be named later, like a baseball player to be named later as part of a trade, that would be enough. If you said, I will grant you three wishes in exchange for the deposit to my Cayman Islands bank account, without saying knowing what the three wishes would be, that would be enough. We're not quarreling with that. We do think that the evidence does not establish any agreement in this case, but that was a question for the jury to decide. Those wedding presents that Larry Warner bought for George Ryan's daughter could have been just wedding presents. Even if the jury could have inferred that maybe there was some agreement there, we don't know whether they would have. And in fact, the court has already answered the critical question in this case. It wrote, Ryan observes that the jury was not required to determine whether Warner's payments were bribes or kickbacks. True enough, the question under the instructions was whether Ryan had received a secret financial benefit. That statement clearly rejected the government's and the district court's argument that the jury was required to determine that Warner's payments were bribes. It recognized that the jury might not have convicted Ryan of criminal conduct, and that should be the end of this case. Now, notice that I've applied the government's proposed harmless error standard without ever discussing, one way or the other, whether the evidence of bribery was overwhelming. It doesn't matter whether the evidence of bribery was overwhelming if the jury had no reason even to consider this evidence. We're talking about the effect of an instructional error on the verdict that was actually rendered. The standard advanced by the government asks whether there was a substantial and injurious effect on this verdict. It isn't this court's job to enter the jury box and say, oh, okay, what the jury probably found Ryan guilty of isn't a crime, but we think he's clearly guilty of doing something else. In the very recent decision, United States against Miller, the court disagreed with the government's claim that its evidence was overwhelming, but it said that even overwhelming evidence would not be conclusive. Our role in deciding whether an error is harmless is not to become, in effect, a second jury to determine whether the defendant was guilty. If the district court had failed to instruct the jury at all about bribery, this court could not say that the error was harmless because the evidence of bribery was overwhelming. And similarly, you can't say that instructing a jury to convict a defendant of smiling is harmless because the evidence clearly established that he robbed a bank. Now, this court didn't say that the evidence of bribery was overwhelming, but it did say that the inference that the payments were bribes verges on the inescapable. I've suggested that even if the inference were entirely inescapable, it's not the court's job to convict Ryan of misconduct that the jury did not find. But I do want to say that the court's view of the evidence was distinctive. The government certainly did not believe that the evidence of bribery was overwhelming. It never mentioned the bribery instructions, never urged conviction on that basis. It was Ryan's counsel who noted those instructions and said that they clearly did not justify conviction. Throughout the trial, the counsel had asked government witnesses, did you ever see any evidence that George Ryan took a bribe? And none of the 83 witnesses said yes. The government's response to this line of argument was always the same. Okay, but that's not our case. We've charged an undisclosed conflict of interest, which is sufficient. At one point, the government even conceded expressly that it had failed to prove the central element of bribery, a quid pro quo. So the jury was instructed to convict Ryan of conduct that is not criminal, and it almost certainly did so. George Ryan is entitled to a new trial. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Marcel.
May it please the court. This court correctly found that the government forfeited, rather than waived, Ryan's procedural default in his post-Skilling instructional challenges when he failed to advocate a construction of Section 1346 that was narrower than the construction that was set forth in United States versus Bloom. The government did not make a knowing and intelligent decision to waive Ryan's default based on his adoption of Bloom because we did not recognize that default.
But as Mr. Altshuler points out, that's not the standard you usually urge for waiver or forfeiture when the shoe is on the other foot. It seems to me Wood against Milliard instructs all of us how we're supposed to approach this. And even forfeiture shouldn't be forgiven unless there's an extraordinarily powerful reason to do so.
That's correct. That is correct. And if this court were to find that the government waived and didn't forfeit, or that the forfeiture, or if this court were to decide to use its discretion not to overlook a forfeiture, then the government's position is that Ryan is still not entitled to any relief here because a review of the record as
what,
a whole...
What would make this an extraordinary case if we would find...
Well, the extraordinary case is what this court actually identified in its opinion. There has been an extraordinary amount of judicial resources that have been expended on this case after a six-month trial and many post-trial proceedings.
Well, yeah, it was a long trial. It was a lot of work on all sides, including the courts, and the appeal was a lot of work and so forth. But in terms of your forfeiture, why did that happen under some extraordinary circumstances? How is this different than every other case?
The forfeiture itself was actually based on a mistake. It was that we did not recognize the default that this court identified.
And I guess the trouble that I have with it is that even in the post-argument brief you submit, you directly assert that it wasn't defaulted, which sure sounds like a waiver to me, if not a forfeiture.
Well, the default that we – the reason why we said that there was no default is because we mistakenly believed that that George Ryan's constitutional his constitutional vagueness claim, that it preserved his post-Skilling instructional challenges.
And you're talking about the motivation for why would you, stand up in court and say we're not doing this, and we don't usually probe the brains of defense counsel or prosecutors or others. If you waive it, you waive it.
Well, as I said, if this court were to rule that we did waive and not forfeit, although the court said that we forfeited in its decision, and so and we believe that the court was correct on that. But if this court were to change its mind and decide that we waived and didn't forfeit, then Ryan is still not entitled to any relief because a review of the record here shows that this was a bribery case.
And even though you said it wasn't, I mean, there's a burden of proof issue here because certainly there are all these benefits flowing to Ryan. Nobody can disagree with that. And your theory, of course, is that it was understood that in exchange for these benefits, Brian would take favorable actions of various kinds, whether, you know, to be named or specifically counsel for Ryan has said doesn't matter, and I agree with that. So why is it Ryan's burden to present an alternative explanation, just, you know, he liked my daughter a lot, or we loved each other's company, and so we spent time in the Bahamas together, or whatever? Why does Ryan have to disprove the motivation that you assert?
Well, Judge, I don't know that Ryan does have to disprove it. I think that the evidence in this case was very clear. With regard to an agreement, the evidence was there was direct evidence of an agreement here. The story begins when Ryan is first elected Secretary of State, and he enters into an arrangement with Larry Warner, where Larry Warner, for the very first time in his life, is going to become a lobbyist in order to cash in on his relationship with George Ryan. And Larry Warner tells Don Utzon that in return he is going to take care of Ryan and he is going to share his lobbying proceeds with Don Utzon, who was a very close friend of George Ryan and who hardly knew Larry Warner. And then the evidence that takes place after that.
Well, aren't you inferring an agreement from that? I mean, you don't see any other reason why this largesse would be forthcoming, I suppose.
Well, Judge, that's correct. And in fact, as the evidence plays out, you see that this arrangement did in fact exist, because George Ryan goes out of his way from that moment forward to try to get as many contracts to Larry Warner's clients as he could, to try to get as many leases to Larry Warner as he could. And in fact, he bends over backwards. He even tells a Secretary of State employee to secretly take back the specifications of a contract so that Larry Warner's clients can retain the contract.
And I agree with you that the evidence, there's a tremendous amount of evidence about all sorts of things like that. So the question is, where's the evidence that at the core of all of this is an agreement, not Ryan just throwing lots of business in the direction of somebody he likes?
Well, I believe, Judge, the agreement with regard to Warner's case, it was an explicit agreement when Larry Warner, one of the defendants, tells Don Utzon that George Ryan has agreed to the arrangement where Larry Warner is going to basically capitalize on his relationship, and Larry Warner is going to take care of George, and also share his lobbying proceeds with Utzon, whose only tie was with George Ryan. And the government argued, the arguments in this case were very explicit with regard to what was going on. What the jury was presented with was this flow of benefits, the Ganim theory, and the evidence was indeed overwhelming, because from the moment that George Ryan went out of his way to give Larry Warner and his clients and Larry Warner as many governmental state actions as he could, then Larry Warner was also producing and giving back to Ryan a flow of benefits, which the government articulated for the jury, and this was what the arguments were all about.
What about the part of the arguments where government counsel says we didn't need to prove a quid pro quo, and we didn't prove a quid pro quo?
Well, Judge, that the argument that Ryan has continuously pushed on that is very misleading. The record is crystal clear that the term quid pro quo, as it was used in this case by both the government and the defense and the judge, consistently was used to refer to the specific this for a specific that, or a one-to-one matchup, as opposed to the flow of benefits. In fact, George Ryan's trial counsel said the following: if quid pro quo means that this money or this benefit is given for this particular official action, and that's what we mean by quid pro quo, then, and I think that's what the court is referring to, I understand that that's not a requirement, that kind of one-to-one matchup is not required. And the jury was, this is how exactly it was explained to the jury. The term quid pro quo was discussed with the jury. This is what the government told the jury. This is not a case in which a public official has a specific price for each official act that he did, like a menu in a restaurant where you pick an item and it has a particular price. The type of corruption where you give me this and I will give you that is often referred to as a quid pro quo. The corruption here was more like a meal plan in which you don't pay for each item on the menu. Rather, there's a cost that you pay, an ongoing cost, and you get your meals. That was how it was explained to the jury. So every time in these collateral proceedings that George Ryan keeps insisting that somehow we told the jury that there didn't need to be an exchange, that's actually very misleading. And quite to the contrary, the government consistently told the jury that there needed to be an exchange, that they had to find an exchange. In fact, both parties, during their arguments, made it very clear to the jury that what the issue was for them to decide is whether or not George Ryan gave out governmental benefits in exchange for personal benefits. What, at the very beginning of their arguments, this is what the government told the jury. Does the evidence, how they framed the issue, does the evidence show that Ryan was willing to sell his public office for his own personal benefit?
So let me ask you a particular question. Remembering that the standard of review, et cetera. So it's the one dealing with count six and Harry Klein.
Yes.
Ryan's vacationing in Jamaica at the villa. Klein tells Ryan he's got a building to lease to the state. Ryan eventually signs that lease, and the state pays arguably way too much money for the lease, $170,000 more than it would have paid. I'm not sure why a jury would have to think that there was even a meal plan, that there was an agreement. Right, the benefit has to be here, the vacation in Jamaica. But we don't know that, and isn't that pretty flimsy evidence, at least enough to give some doubt?
Judge, I take great exception with that. The evidence on Harry Klein was and that whole episode was by far not flimsy. What the evidence was that George Ryan didn't even know Harry Klein. They had no relationship at all until Harry Klein started giving him these free vacations in Jamaica. And then it became very clear, and as counsel said, the agreement can be implicit, does not have to be explicit. But the evidence was overwhelming that there was an implicit agreement here, because from almost the very first years, it was very clear that George Ryan, while he was enjoying the benefits, the personal benefits that he was getting from Harry Klein, there was an arrangement where he was going to be returning those benefits, but by way of governmental benefits. So, for example, the very first one is they're sitting at the picnic table in Jamaica when Harry Klein says that he would like to have the currency exchange rate increase, and sure enough, that's exactly what George grants him. The evidence was basically that whatever Harry wanted, George was there to provide to him, and it was very clear that it was constantly in connection with the benefits he was receiving. In fact, that lease that Judge Wood, that you talked about, that lease, George Ryan started arranging for that lease in December of 1996, which was just a few weeks before the annual January vacation. So he already started telling the Secretary of State employees to do a lease for Harry Klein. And so then he goes to the vacation spot. They're sitting around the picnic table. They're talking about the lease. He's able to basically say, I'm holding up my end of this deal here. When he comes back from that vacation, he's all over this. He wants that lease, and he wants it done now, and he tells the Secretary of State employees that the terms of the lease should be whatever Harry wants.
All right, so I just want to finish up, though, and say, you know, that is certainly a way that you could look at this evidence, but don't we need to find that it's the only way?
Well, Judge, I think that under the instructions that were given in this case, that was the only way that you could see this. The only undisclosed interest that Ryan had in the governmental actions that he took, which is in order to qualify under an undisclosed conflict of interest, were the benefits that he received in return for those actions. And in fact, Judge, there were other instructions here. The jury had to review all the instructions as a whole, and we can be sure that the jury found the connection between the benefits that George Ryan was getting and the benefits and the governmental action that he was taking because of the financial benefits instruction, which told the jury that they could not convict unless they found that Ryan received the benefits with the understanding that they were given to influence his decision-making. This was the cornerstone, by the way, of the defense argument. The defense told the jury throughout their argument that if they did not find that George Ryan was influenced in his state action by the benefits that he was receiving, that they had to acquit. We never quarreled with that. What we said is that's exactly what he did. In fact, we said George Ryan was influenced in his state action by the benefits that he was receiving. That was the case that took place here. Counsel is referring to some case that never happened. That was the case that happened here. You have to look at the record as a whole. All of the cases say that the standard of review depends on a review of the entire record, which includes, of course, the arguments, the evidence, and the instructions. And in this case, there was also the flow of benefits instruction, which told the jury that the government has to prove that the government official accepted benefits with the understanding that he would perform or not perform acts in his official capacity in return. Somehow, counsel for George Ryan would have this court believe that the jury disregarded all the other instructions. But even under the conflict of interest instruction, there had to be a connection. And that's how the government explained the conflict of interest instruction to the jury.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Barcella. Anything further, Mr. Altshuler?
Once more, the government claims that there is direct evidence of an agreement. Larry Warner said that he would take care of Ryan. We've responded to that repeatedly. In evaluating questions of harmless error, a court can't assume that the jury credited the government's evidence unless the jury must have credited that evidence to reach the verdict that it did. We've made that point again and again. The government hasn't disagreed, and yet the government continues to recite in every filing and again today that evidence that was highly contested and that the jury need not have found to be true, including that statement. It comes from Don Udston, who was facing serious charges himself, who had admitted committing perjury on prior occasions, who admitted lying to hundreds of people, whose statement to the grand jury was inconsistent with the statement he made at trial, and who was strongly urged not to be believed in this case. The government says there was a clear understanding with Harry Klein from year one. Well, it took a long time to act on it. 2 years later, at the picnic table, I don't know if it would have been different if Klein had come to the office, but 2 years after this supposed agreement, Klein mentions that it hasn't been a rate increase for 10 years, and there's been inflation, and could he think about it? So apparently, if a businessman entertains a public official or has him as a house guest and discusses any governmental business in which the businessman is interested, there's only one way to understand it. The jury had to find that was a bribe. 4 years after this supposed agreement, we have the lease that occurs in this case. I suggest that this was plainly a question for the jury to decide, and we have no reason to believe that they decided it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.